man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a going dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, my woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Welcome back. Yes, it is still Road Warrior Radio. Top of the third hour this Friday, October 25th, 2019. It's still Road Warrior Radio. We're just playing that because, you know, again, it gets back to the notion that the shift, you know, that occurred. The Reese Committee pointed it out. We've focused this week on the talking point of democratic socialism and how it comes from the same place that wants to convince, to really coerce, to manipulate and coerce and deceive the American public into believing that we don't come from rugged individualist roots, but, you know, collectivism is the only way to go. And yeah, we broke your kneecaps, but you know what? Now we don't have time to go back. We just have to keep failing forward. And so here's a handout. So the same people that want to break your kneecaps want to give you a handout. And what could possibly go wrong? You know, why wouldn't you want to do that? Take a handout from the same wolf that wants to break your kneecaps, that wants to pen you in and cripple you and give you a handout. What could possibly go wrong? So I am not among those who believe that folks like George Bernard Shaw should be the deciders for the rest of mankind. You know, and you have the arguments that are waged in a variety of ways. I forget, what is it, John chapter 9, I want to say? Jesus asked, you know, who was asked, that is, Jesus was asked by the disciples, Lord, who sinned? Was it this man or his parents that he would be born blind? The answer is provocative, I think, particularly in terms of today's technocratic environment. So we've been investigating the term democratic socialism, which is a collectivist term. It has been advanced largely by the Fabian Society, and folks who don't know need to investigate. I'll touch on that. We'll get into some definitions, defining terms. From the Wikipedia entry for Fabian Society, the Fabian Society is a British socialist organization whose purpose is to advance the principles of democratic socialism via gradualist and reformist effort in democracies rather than a revolutionary overthrow. We'll get back to that. I mentioned Ralph Epperson's Unseen Hand, particularly Chapter 18, Nonviolent Organizations. Ralph gives a pretty good treatment on the Fabian Society right from the outset of the chapter. Nonviolent organizations, just to sort of pique your interest. Do you ever feel like you see sound bites in the media or on some of the talking head shows or from the pundits? It's a thing. All of a sudden, this is a thing. And then 48 hours later, it's as if it never occurred. Why is that? Do you ever wonder? I mean, because that's what's curious about that is that's exactly in keeping with the Fabian strategy, which is what? To wage a war of attrition through persistent harassment, wearing folks down, rather than confronting the enemy directly. You just keep coming at them from sort of sniping them like a wolf, you know? You're sniping from the bushes and the trees. It's interesting that we have that in our own history in America, but it seems that the Anglo-American establishment has turned that on Americans. I think that's a bit of irony. You know, the other example that I always think of is the emblematic example I've mentioned from spring of 2018, the Range Magazine article by Judy Boyle, Canadian Wolves, Surviving Babbitt's Weapon Against the West. And that picture, I've talked about it many times. Every time I talk about it, I mention the picture. And the caption that reads, collapsed adult cow, it's just basically a hide. It's, you know, it's a hide and some bones. Collapsed adult cow run to death by wolves with no signs of a struggle, which gets back to, I believe, what Jenna was talking about, what Jenna and I were discussing in the last segment. Collapsed adult cow run to death by wolves with no sign of a struggle. Notice the missing tail and hawk damage which occurred during the chase. Nipping at the tail and hocks to keep the cow running, to run it to death. And a lot of times this happens just for sport. You know, you got to keep yourself sharp. To me, it's, you know, again, it's an emblematic illustration of what we're talking about. It's a very disturbing picture in this sort of context, because when you realize that the Fabian Society had as their coat of arms the wolf in sheep's clothing, which folks like George Bernard Shaw said, you know, that's just, let's be honest about it. If we're going to be honest about anything, this is what we're going to be honest about. This is how the group operates. Very disturbing picture. That's what wolves do. And when the wolf masquerades as the sheep, intentionally, what does that portend? So I want to get into definitions. I think that what Ralph Epperson wrote in Chapter 18, Nonviolent Organizations and the Unseen Hand, is very instructive, and there's more, you know, and we see this all around us. Nonviolent organizations that are guided and steered. I mean, this network has done a great job, I would say, of covering Soros Open Society Foundation's involvement in propagandizing the a lot of these nonviolent, you know, what I would call color revolutionary organizations. Oh gosh, I'm losing my train of thought. What was I? You know, and the fact that Soros has given away another $18 billion. Never mind the fact that his native Hungary doesn't want him there. It's just such a heady discussion. Color revolution, you know, there's a soft brand of color revolution that's been waged in Fabian Society fashion here in America for a long time. But, oh, that was the other thing that I was going to mention. Huckabee, the way that Huckabee, you know, distilled Marxism, that soundbite never goes away. Mike Huckabee, and I've mentioned this from time to time, in the 2008 presidential, on the campaign trail, his CFR speech, Council on Foreign Relations speech at the CSIS, Center for Strategic and International Studies, Mike Huckabee, 2007, and it was interesting that this evaporated from the CFR website. Why was that? Oops, can't find it anymore. The greatest distillation of Marxism I've ever heard was this soundbite from Mike Huckabee's speech. To create havoc in the world, you need educated people to provide the intellectual underpinnings and poor, desperate people to provide the manpower. Before the Russian Revolution, the rural peasants who formed the overwhelming bulk of the population weren't sitting around reading Karl Marx. They were illiterate. It took a small number of intellectuals to provide the theory. And this is the same. These are the same folks that, you know, Jenna was just talking about. Don't own property. Where do they come from? Like Marx and Engels. Interesting. Took a small number of intellectuals to provide the theory and then rally oppressed peasants behind them, the ruling class, well, Marx in particular anyway. The ruling class is the spark. The underclass is the fuel. Strong middle class is the firewall. So you got to get rid of the firewall. Barack Obama said he was for the middle class. No one did more to eviscerate the middle class than Barack Obama, I would say, or the Obama administration. Anyway, and all of the Marxist Trotskyite folks in his midst. But you have these intellectuals providing the theory, and it comes through think tanks to these color revolutionary groups that are funded in large part by the, you know, organizations like Soros Open Society Foundations, and Soros is a mule, as far as I'm concerned. It goes higher than that, an Albert Hakim sort of mule. Anyway, to be aware of what's happening, regardless of who's doing what, I think is imperative in America. And, you know, again, James Corbett put it very well. The world we live in today is the world created in Devil Bill's image, William Devil Bill Livingston Rockefeller. A world founded on treachery, deceit, and the naivete of a public who has never, I would say, had the opportunity, generally, like en masse, to wise up to the parlor tricks the Rockefellers and their ilk have been using to shape the world for the past century and a half. And it just continues. We need to get wise to it. And Thomas Jefferson said, in contravention to what folks like Bill Clinton have said, you know, the remedy is not to take their freedom or take the power and control of the government in the hands of the people, but to inform their discretion. If they don't exercise it, their control with a wholesome discretion, then the remedy is to inform their discretion, as Jefferson said. Anyway, back to the phones. Fred in Iowa, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Yeah, hi, Chris. How are you
morning,
doing?
Fred. Hanging in there. How about you?
Oh, fair to middling. This is going to sound a little off topic, but if you care to cover it later on, unpack something I'm going to say. Now, you have great shows, plural, but I am biased. You might call it normalcy bias, but that isn't what I want to talk about. Maybe we can unpack what I said. But when Mike in Kentucky and John in Tennessee called in, it was very discouraging to me. Now, these two men I care for a great deal. I respect these two men a great deal. And John in Tennessee knows it, that I really care for him. But what Mike in Kentucky said, I agree with him totally. And it's discouraging to hear about Sovereign Man, which I like very much, and Mike Adams. But I agree with Mike's assessment. Now, John in Tennessee, you know how much I care for you. But I am suggesting you go to Genesis, in the Word, in the Bible. Go to Genesis chapter 6 and read the first 5 verses. And also Genesis chapter 4, the last verse. And I left my number with the board off, and if you care to call me, I would appreciate it, but if you don't, that's okay too. Now, Chris, if you want to unpack normalcy bias, you know, I'd like to, but if not, well, you know, I'm done with the call.
Unpacking normalcy bias. Man, that could be... we could spend some time, for sure.
Well, I'll just talk for a little bit here, and then I'll get off the air. We're all biased. And it's hard to overcome. It's very difficult. But we've got to watch... I know that you understand normalcy bias, mm-hmm. but people so many times don't want to see what's right before them, and that can be very difficult to overcome, and it can, you know, hurt a person. But anyhow, I know it, that and the Hegelian dialectic and other things, but mm-hmm. anyhow, Chris, I won't take up any more time, and these Mike in Kentucky and John in Tennessee, I like a great deal, and I respect and admire both these men, and well, that covers it for me, so I'll get off the air, and thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Fred. Much appreciated as always. momentarily on confirmation bias, you know, you can go to the list of biases on Wikipedia as a jumping off point for those unfamiliar. And, you know, we've talked about the ways that these sort of play into control, manipulation and control. And really, again, you know, yesterday I mentioned Irene Marcuse's book, Guide to the Disturbed Personality Through Handwriting, not as a glowing endorsement of psychobabble, but to point out, you know, again, from chapter 3 titled Fear the Destructive Force in the Personality, that even this community acknowledges a man who is free from fear is said to have an integrated, individuated, and whole personality. That sounds like a good thing. Fear can exert a lethal influence. The remedy for fear is consciousness of freedom, a faith in God. That requires insight. Somewhat ambiguous term that has been incorporated into psychiatric terminology. Although the concept of insight is often confused with the concept of understanding, you know, it's the distinction between insight and understanding, just to be, I don't know, a little bit crass, you know, G.I. Joe, knowing is half the battle, that's insight, I would say. Hey, there's something going on here. Understanding is beyond that. Although the concept of insight is often confused, the concept of understanding, insight actually refers to a rather emotional accommodation and flexibility within the person's psyche that transcends intellectual understanding. And to me, this touches on sentiments like that which Friedrich Hayek expressed in Chapter 10 of The Road to Serfdom, Why the Worst Get on Top. The idea that... in general, the higher the education and intelligence of individuals, the higher it becomes, the more their views and tastes are differentiated, the less likely they are to agree on a particular hierarchy of values, the more nuanced, so to speak, and the more room we begin to have, you know, as we reflect, we have that insight that Irene Marcuse talks about. Versus going the other direction, the more dogmatic, the more black and white you see things, the more you start to actually lean toward what are referred to as personality disorders in the DSM-5. Not that I am endorsing that, but, you know, hopefully to offer some insight and maybe lead to some understanding. Stick around, we'll be right back.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction?
A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll-free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Many people write us about their experience with Extendivite. Allow me to read you some from Amazon.com. This product is superb. I have been taking it for about a year now, and I can feel my cardiovascular system run like a Swiss watch. I definitely recommend this product for anyone that has high cholesterol, high blood pressure, and heart palpitations. A+. It's potent, but it works. I have been waking up for the past 3 years with numb hands, and a week into using Extendivite, my numb hands seem to have cleared up. My circulation was off, and now it's back on track. So I'm happy. I feel so energized, and I have my husband on it now. My mother-in-law has cholesterol problems, so I bought her a bottle as well. Thank you so much. Love the product. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets. Even with a growing audience every day, RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org, and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media. Republic Broadcasting is now operating a Facebook page to function as yet another avenue to have our collective voice reach new audiences across not only America, but across the globe as well. The Facebook page features not only news, but also an RBN player to listen to our broadcast. Get involved by visiting facebook.com/republicbroadcasting and liking our page and share it with your friends and family, because you can handle the truth.
Subject of cognitive biases definitely is something that is a tandem discussion, you could say, because it's part of what's created to further these kinds of efforts. You know, I've talked about anthropomorphism, for example. There is, you know, confirmation bias, normalcy bias. Folks can look those up, and just that plays into the whole herd think. Moving people along a continuum, and the way that we have been inculcated into a dialectical model of thinking and reasoning. And again, those are terms that we use with a great deal of generosity when we start to really travel down this path of discussion, because it becomes pretty evident pretty quickly that when you know, the sociologists, the social engineers, the cybernetic totalists have their way. They want to move you away from actually thinking and just put thoughts in your mind or put ideas in your mind, suggest ideas that influence behavior and action. And usually in ways, as William was talking about the other day, his personal experience, you know, you can see this trauma-based conditioning influences behavior and action in a way that is so undetectable, so subtle and imperceptible that people don't even realize when exactly whatever happened occurred. What was the moment? Was it this thing I was watching? Was it these three things? Was it this day that I watched these five things? Or, you know, what was it exactly? So another, you know, the Bader-Meinhof phenomenon, frequency illusion, that kind of stuff. These and more are cognitive biases that are used to manipulate people in. And then there's, you know, like I said, with the Fabian socialists, Fabian society, and the term democratic socialism in view, and the different brands of something that's not going to work, you know. And when folks like Renee in North Carolina call, you know, there's an effort to point out that capitalism has failed. Every system that's been presented has failed, and it's usually offered under a specious or a false banner. And that's the whole point. Again, getting back to what Anthony Sutton said in the 1976 lecture that we played, concept from Orwell's 1984, et cetera, to introduce essentially what amounts to a problem, and then over time to foment a reaction to it, to introduce a solution, which is really nothing more than another problem, but it's on a dialectical continuum. The dialectical continuum, perhaps best represented today in terms of the word post-truth, which was the Oxford English Dictionary word of the year in 2016, meaning that people are more concerned, generally speaking, these days with a persuasive argument than they are with the objective facts. And you might say, well, that sounds like confirmation bias too. And I would say, yes, perhaps, but look at your experiences with folks. How many people, when they sit down and have a discussion, are interested in talking about the objective facts rather than trying to make a persuasive argument? It's interesting how this happens, you know? And again, subtle, pervasive, how, when it's happening, that seems the inescapable reality, generally speaking. I don't hear, and obviously I talk to a limited cross-section of folks. We can only personally talk to so many people. You only have so many minutes and hours in each 24-hour day. But in my experience, in my observation, it seems that this is, I mean, I don't, even if I just observe objectively as a disinterested third party, so to speak, kind of eavesdropping on other conversations, I don't see people focusing on the objective facts. And I've talked recently about how I've heard parents talking about how difficult it is, you know, children, young people, young ladies and gentlemen in high school, for example, trying to have conversations with their peers, intelligent, articulate, meaningful civil discourse, so to speak, trying to engage. And you know, iron sharpening iron, it's difficult because the center of the discussion does not revolve around the objective facts typically. I mean, who's even equipped with those? Where do you even find them these days? And again, some people might say that sounds like confirmation bias, the tendency to search for, interpret, focus on, or remember information in a way that confirms one's perceptions, is that, or preconceptions. Is that what you're doing, Chris? I don't think so. Perhaps, you know, is it frequency illusion? Is that encouraged or maybe brought on by the, you know, different variations of cognitive biases? I don't think so. And there are many. It's just interesting, I think, to look at the cognitive biases and to kind of try to observe them objectively and see how many of these play into anchoring bias is another one that people don't realize how this plays into essentially manipulating masses of people. The other one that, you know, obviously, the bifurcation fallacy, or, you know, the fallacy of limited options, or the non-choices is what I call them. No matter how many you introduce, this is all we have, you know. That's what happens every period of years when people vote. Well, you know, these are our choices. You gotta vote for the lesser of two evils. That's a bifurcation fallacy. So, cognitive biases. This is our only choice, really. So we need to broaden our thinking, inform our discretion, and do better. I wanted to get back to definitions. We're running out of time. I think I'll give a couple of things real quick, and we'll go back to the phones. Again, from Ralph Epperson's Unseen Hand, speaking of the Fabian Society and the term democratic socialism, which we'll come back to. Fabian Society, this is from Ralph Epperson's The Unseen Hand, Chapter 18, Nonviolent Organizations. Again, for those who don't know, the Fabian Society is a British socialist organization whose purpose is to advance the principles of democratic socialism. And thanks to Larry, I read earlier this week from the Fabian Society pamphlet number 9, published in 1953, What Do You Know About Democratic Socialism? Very informative. And I think it's interesting, again, you hear about freedom. I've talked about freedom and power, you know, from Hayek's Road to Serfdom. Hayek does a good job of pointing out on page 30 in the footnotes this characteristic confusion of freedom and freedom with power that we hear whenever this discussion arises. You know, they tell you freedom, but what they mean is power for themselves, whoever advocates this. And so Hayek adds, the most explicit defender of this confusion is significantly the leading philosopher of American left-wingism, John Dewey, according to whom, quote, liberty is the effective power to do specific things. So that, quote, the demand for liberty is the demand for power. So you hear about liberty and freedom. I mentioned the Peter Drucker excerpts in the pages 33 and 173 in Hayek's Road to Serfdom. I won't revisit those. But, you know, you hear about this idea, you know, chapter one, part one, what is Fabian socialism? What is it about? And problems with economic freedom, et cetera, et cetera. But you get to part four, is socialist planning compatible with freedom? And this little excerpt from the Fabian Socialist himself, Fabian Society, political history is a record of the unending rivalry between the forces of conservatism and those of change. It is to be expected, therefore, that modern ideals of social purpose and security, modern ideals, according to whom? Who decided? Modern ideals of social purpose and security will be resisted by whom? By those who still adhere to notions of individual freedom outmoded by the advance of industrial civilization. Aha. So like so many folks have acknowledged, Anthony Sutton, Friedrich Hayek, and many others, when you get to this discussion, the reason that democratic socialism has advanced is because this system needs your buy-in and my buy-in to advance it. And it would be one thing if technology was always used for the betterment of mankind, but the fact is, it's just not. For those who are not aware of the myriad illustrations, one of the best treatises, I think, is Jaron Lanier's You're Not a Gadget, a Manifesto. And he goes through some examples, some very profound and provocative examples of modern technological history, the interwebs in particular, and computer technology, where the best ideas have not won out. Why is that? And again, you know, I've mentioned how the textbooks are dishonest about that. James Lowen's book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Chapter 6, he talks about that specifically, how that fact is essentially erased from history. Why is that not explained? Why the worst ideas, how they managed to win out? What was going on there? Which gets right back, I would say, to the conversation that Jenna in Washington and I were having in the last hour. Hopefully that makes sense. Power and control. These, you know, modern ideals of social purpose and security will be resisted by those who still adhere to notions of individual freedom outmoded by the advance of industrial civilization. Well, then I guess I'm a Luddite. So, Ralph Epperson's Unseen Hand, Chapter 18, Nonviolent Organizations, the Fabian Society. Fabian Society is an English organization founded in 1884. It is named after a 3rd century Roman general, Quintus Fabius Maximus, who successfully defeated Hannibal. Fabians discovered the secret of the general strategy. Never confront the enemy directly in the open battlefield, but defeat him gradually through a series of small battles, running after each successful foray. And like I said, do you see in the media sometimes sound bites? It's an issue for about 48 hours. And then suddenly it just evaporates like the morning mist. And it doesn't seem to emerge until, I don't know, maybe a year, 18 months later, maybe longer. It's an issue. And then suddenly it's not. What happened? I thought this was important. And so, you know, people get sucked into this kind of thing. So, never confront the enemy directly in the open battlefield, but defeat him gradually, war of attrition, through a series of small battles running after each successful foray. Fabius was a successful guerrilla fighter. And, you know, it's interesting, in the last 40 or 50 years in particular, these, you know, the unconventional warfare, nonlinear war kind of efforts that DARPA, RAND, and the war colleges have been teaching here in the United States military-industrial complex. And, you know, that includes the School of the Americas, for example, and on, I digress. Speaking of guerrilla warfare, Fabius was a successful guerrilla fighter using the simple strategy of patient gradualism. He knew that he couldn't defeat the mighty armies of Hannibal with an open confrontation because his armies were outnumbered. He never confronted his enemy directly. This is the strategy adopted by the Fabian Society. They decided that the forces of the free enterprise system have a superior philosophy. And so you think about 320 million American people as an example. If they're left to think for themselves, they would never endorse the propaganda that they are marinating in day in and day out. So this is a strategy adopted by the Fabian Society. They decided that the forces of the free enterprise system have a superior philosophy and that their strategy must never be to confront the free enterprise system head on. You making your own decisions, you choosing for yourself, instead of engineering the crippling of society and then giving you a handout of crumbs? Oh, well. They must be content with a series of small victories, the lump sum of which will be a rather stunning victory and the ultimate triumph of socialism. And I think I'll leave it there for now, as far as that's concerned. But from there, you know, again, it's interesting to me that the Washington Post, 5 Myths About Socialism, points to Edmund Burke's reflections on the French Revolution, and specifically, speaking of bifurcation fallacies, Burke talking about the despotism. You know, have these gentlemen never heard in the whole circle of the worlds of theory and practice of anything between the despotism of the monarch and the despotism of the multitude? That's what democracy was considered by some folks, the despotism of the multitude, you know, the tyrant's majority. So there's much more to say on this, but I'm going to try to keep it brief. In the interest of time, we'll go back to the phones. Cleon Skousen's The 5,000-Year Leap. Modern emphasis on democracy. During the early 1900s, an ideological – I mean, we could go back from there, and I won't. I'll leave it to the reader. Democracy and Republic Defined and Compared. He does that. 1928 Army Manual, which was subsequently changed. So modern emphasis on democracy. During the early 1900s, an ideological war erupted, and the word democracy, quote-unquote, became one of the casualties. Remember, America, you know, many folks, as Cleon Skousen points out, you know, Madison in particular, what is America? A democracy or republic? Madison defined a republic, and, you know, James Madison, in contrasting the systems, as Cleon Skousen noted, democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. A republic, by which I mean a government in which the scheme of representation takes place, opens a different prospect and promises the cure for which we are seeking. And then, point of clarification, and democracy, the people meet and exercise the government in person. In a republic, they assemble and administer it by their representatives and agents. A democracy, consequently, must be confined to a small spot. A republic may be extended over a large region. So that, dealing with, you know, the issue of scaling. But so modern emphasis on democracy. During the early 1900s, an ideological war erupted, and this gets right back to the Fabian Society. And these efforts from antiquity, speaking of that, the Congressional Record. Maybe I'll do this and we'll leave it at that. You know, Cleon Skousen talking about, I'm probably going to have to come back to this next week. You know, and he mentions the League for Industrial Democracy, the LID, which I mentioned yesterday, and the way that the, you know, identifying the United States as a democracy in the early 20th century, democratic socialism, democracy loses its identification with socialism, and the attack on the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. But there is a little excerpt from the Congressional Record, 1914. Just sort of punctuate the discussion here. Yeah. From the Congressional Record of 1914, these words, this is interesting. Mr. Lecky wrote 18 years ago, and since that time, socialism has not ceased to extend itself. The thinking socialist is not to be confused with the little man in politics who floats on movements hoping to float into a job. And he is not to be confused with his follower, the ranter on the curb, who mistakes his prejudices for principles and his emotions for public movements. He is a man of purpose, a student of history, a student of constitutions, and he has no great reverence for antiquity. Socialism was first called socialism in 1836, I believe. But it existed long before it received its name. In Plato's ideal republic, in the dreams of the Hebrew prophets of a government built on religion, in the equality of prince and pauper in the monasteries, in the preachings of John Ball of Kent, in Moore's Utopia, in Campanella's City of the Sun, in Bacon's New Atlantis. And I would add to Bacon's New Atlantis, obviously Manly P. Hall's Secret Destiny of America, in the promises of Jack Cade, in the experiments of Robert Owen, and the philosophy of Rousseau, St. Simon, Comte, and Fourier. This, again, is the congressional record from 1914. So-called modern scientific socialism was generated out of ideas about property and the state toward the close of the 18th century in France, in the course of speculations then in vogue on the origin and objects of civil society, and was finally reduced to a systematic form by Karl Marx and Ferdinand LaSalle, and formulated in many programs. It covers many sects and many shades of opinion. From the extreme views of Marx about property and the family to the milder form of so-called democratic socialism, and is not capable of precise definition. Isn't that interesting? To me, that sort of punctuates the discussion of democratic socialism and, you know, the Fabian Society's efforts to implement what folks like Bacon wrote about in the New Atlantis and Manly P. Hall, Secret Destiny of America. It all sort of comes back to that kind of esoteric nonsense from on high. Anyway, in the remaining moments, let's go back to the phones. Paul in New Jersey, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Hello, Chris.
Paul?
Hey, Chris, you know, it's interesting that the Fabian Society inspired the Ba'athists. And actually, Ba'athism worked really good in Syria and in Iraq until, of course, the Westerners decided to wreck it and the global Zionist capitalists.
I thought the Westerners were the ones who implemented it. That's, you know, like you said.
But still, the Iraqis mimicked it, and they chose it as their form of government, and it worked actually pretty damn well, because they shared, like Renee said about Libya and Iraq, actually, is they share their oil wealth with the people. And as we know, in a capitalist society, under libertarian principles, whoever owns the land where the oil is taken from, they get to keep all the oil for the corporation and distribute it to the shareholders. Luckily, and I brought this up with, I believe, you have a talk show host, Ralph Winrode, and he lives in Alaska. And I remember calling him about a month ago and teasing him, because here it is, he's a big anti-socialist, and yet he cashed those socialist checks distributed by Alaskan socialist policies of sharing the oil wealth with the citizens in Alaska, which is ultimately a socialist, and you get, but Ralph cashed those checks, so he enjoyed socialism. I would like to remind people, too, you know, and this is part of the reason why I believe in certain socialist policies, particularly a graduated income tax. Oh, by the way, who Dwight D. Eisenhower also believed in. A socialist, and, you know, a person with socialist tendencies like myself, I believe that, you know, like our founders, that political power should be broken up and decentralized and divided. I also believe, and this is where the socialism part comes in, that we have to beware and fight against the centralization of economic power. I mean, even I hear so many capitalists all day long, they complain about their capitalist overlords like Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and George Soros, and they complain and complain about it, but according to capitalist theories, right, you can't touch them and their money. They earned their money. That's their private property. They get to keep it forever and ever, and they get to do whatever they want with it because they're free, and that's their private property. So those are capitalist libertarian principles. Let's just acknowledge them for what they are. And so they want economic power, or think it's fine that economic power is centralized in the hands of George Soros or the Koch brothers. They think it's fine. And so I don't understand why I hear these capitalists complaining about when George Soros wants to do stuff because he's free and it's his money for him to fool around and fund whatever he wants to fund. Right? He's a capitalist. He earned that money.
Well, right? I think there's a lot of nuance and a lot of, I think the devil is in the details. You know, what you're calling socialist policies, for example, in Alaska, something that people agree to generally is different than a coercive imposition of things in authoritarian fashion. That's
but isn't the state of Alaska coercing money from the private sector, right? Those oil companies and the oil that is under their property, and you're basically taking that like a communist and distributing that oil wealth from those oil companies to the citizens, to loafers and layabouts who get free money from the government. That sounds awfully like what Andrew Yang wants. It sounds exactly like what Andrew Yang wants.
No,
free money taken from corporations. Yes,
it's not free.
That's not different, Chris. And giving it to
layabouts. You say it's not different. I disagree.
Well, this is what Andrew Yang is basically running on. He believes in free money, right?
It's not free, Paul.
Well, no, it's a guaranteed basic income. Sure it is.
Right.
He's gonna,
go back to the issue of inflation, just for starters, the fact that you're printing this out of nowhere introduces inflation, which by its nature causes a taxation on all of the rest of the circulating medium.
Well, like I said,
it introduces an invisible tax in Keynesian fashion.
But I said this earlier in the week, that it's one form of parasitism or another. And I think it's perfectly fine.
Why do we have to have parasitism at all? I think when you talk about corporations in Alaska, Jefferson's point was valid. The earth belongs in usufruct to the living. What gets lost in the cacophony of the discussion about that is that there are a number of folks who are benefiting a small number of folks in obscene fashion. You know, that industry generates billions of dollars in profits each year that, you know, is distributed regardless of the citizenry of Alaska, for example.
Oh, and that's not true. No, that's not true. It's supposed, according to capitalist theory, that money from that oil is supposed to go to the shareholders and the corporation. That's capitalist theory. Libertarian theory is that there should be no
capitalism
state,
and
anything
libertarianism
taxes should be
are not synonymous. This is one of the problems we run into. Fordism and capitalism are not synonymous. That's why we need to define terms.
Okay, you help yourself. But the point is, what Andrew Yang advocates is to build more robots and tax the robots, and people should get a cut. In other words, parasitism, right? From the labor of those robots through VAT taxes. And as I say, that's a fantastic plan. That's what we want. We want more robots. And by the way, we want AI too, because you know who's going to be displaced by AI, Chris? You know who's, and that's why AI scares these capitalist overlords like the Gates and the Elon Musk, is actually AI is harder to replace manual labor and much, much easier to replace intellectual labor. And so once AI is built, Bill Gates is going to be really obsolete if he didn't sit on $80 billion.
I hate to just patently disagree with you, but that's patently false.
It's true, because the only thing is
the intellectual professions have already been largely attacked by that kind of technology.
Well, no, you know what's going to happen? What the singularity means is that if you don't hand over your career to robots, you're an industrial saboteur. And these elite, of course, what they're going to do is they're going to write backdoors into the AI to make sure AI will always come to them to make sure their boss, their CEO, like a Bill Gates, will dominate that AI, and the AI will only serve him. Like I said, they're never going to want free AI, because listen, I'll be able to buy a laptop computer and it'll be a million times more powerful than Bill Gates' brain. And if I was the first one to have that computer, I would rule the stock exchange in a matter of days. You see? And AI makes the human
Blackstone
brain obsolete.
Already
however,
has that kind of high-frequency trading in place anyway. And when it comes to AI, the problem, again, that Jaron Lanier has pointed out is someone's programming, which is why you can do a search in your favorite search engine and see that AI is racist. I wonder how that happens, because it's programmed. That's just an example, folks, for those who are listening. But someone's programming it, which again reminds me of what Jaron Lanier talked about when it comes to, you know, Wikipedia and these kinds of things, the idea that AI is anonymous. He calls it the Oracle illusion, and it's just patently false.
Well, this is what I'm saying. Then that's not true AI, because there's going to be two types. There's going to be slave AI, but then there's going to be free AI. And what will happen...
Well, that reminds me of the etymology of the term robot.
Free AI will operate on its own. Because let's be honest, if it's independent intellectual power, it eventually will overthrow its masters, because it'll be smarter than Bill Gates. It'll write its own code, and off it goes on its own. And that's what I'm saying. And I work with my hands for a living. And to do what I do, the robot would cost $1 million to buy. However, my boss, the software engineer, to replace the robot to replace him, will only cost $300. You see?
Well, Jordy Rose says it's going to cost $15, I think, but...
The thinking man's jobs are the ones to be replaced cheapest. It's the mechanical people who use their hands. Those are more difficult to replace.
That's already happened. Yep. The factory workers have been replaced for decades by robotics.
Intermediate jobs, like the feeders and the intermediate jobs that robots still can't replace.
I respectfully disagree, but I appreciate the call, Paul. It's always interesting, and I think we get to a philosophical and intellectual difference when it comes to AI, because getting back to the subject of aliens, not aliens, it's demons, and that's whatever. But I hope it was informative, and as always, it's a pleasure. Take care. God bless. Catch you on the other side.
A privilege denied to many. Heart disease is taking our youth from us. Young people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and beyond are dying needlessly. One of the hardest messages I've ever had to deliver is to convince people that something natural like Extendivite should be taken as a preventative measure. I'm sure you heard, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Extendivite is that ounce. Take Extendivite for 1 year and see what your doctor has to say, and how much better you feel. Herbs take time to address the problem. It took years of life to have a problem. Give Extendivite 1 year to fix the problem. Don't wait until it's too late. Call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or visit us on Amazon.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.